Oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the Honorable Court is now sitting. God save this Honorable Court in the State of Texas.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the Court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of presentation, they are E.H. Bernard II and others versus the State of Texas and the General Land Office in Collingsworth County, and NRA Users System Services Incorporated and others on original mandamus proceeding. In each case, the petitioner or relator has been allotted 20 minutes to present argument and the respondent 20 minutes. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. We'll take a brief recess in between the two arguments. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape by making application with the clerk's office. We are ready for argument for petitioners in Brainerd versus State.
May it please the Court, Mr. Michael Powell will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Mr. Harrell, Mr. Sheets, and I represent approximately 30 citizens who own private lands along the Canadian River in Roberts and Hutchinson counties in the Panhandle. As we see this case, it turns on extremely well-established principles of property law, which I'd like to mention very briefly. First, our client's lands were patented out of the State of Texas as riparian lands. They are, and they are entitled to remain, adjacent to the river, which is the essence and the very most valuable feature of riparianness. Second, what the state owns is the bed of the river. No one disputes that.
When you say adjacent to the river, do you mean that it must have actual contact with the water?
What we mean, Your Honor, is that the boundary line is marked along a bank, which is a bank that contains the flowing water of the river. So we don't contend, as the state has asserted, that the water line itself marks the boundary. We contend and we understand from Oklahoma versus Texas and Colonel Stiles' writings that the line is along a bank, but that bank is the water line. That bank is the bank that confines the river to its normal course, or confines the river during its normal flow during the course of a year. I think one of the best ways to visualize that, and I've tried to visualize it this way, is to consider the one occasion on which Colonel Stiles said that the gradient boundary is at the water line. And let me talk just a minute about the gradient boundary. I'd like to try to make that simple if possible. It's somewhat of a mystifying concept, I think, as you read it through the cases. Essentially, one finds the boundary bank, which has been described in the literature in the Oklahoma versus Texas opinion as the water wash bank, does confine the river. Then on that bank, the gradient boundary surveyor, a state licensed land surveyor, will find a key bank, a qualified bank. The purpose of finding that bank is to mark the height, the elevation of the boundary on the bank. So one finds a bank, and one looks at the toe of the bank and the top of the bank just before the water overflows the bank, and one marks a midpoint on that bank. And that is a benchmark. That is a height of the gradient boundary. And then one imagines a plane formed by the surface of the flowing water that's attached right at that point. And then one takes that plane down the river, and where that plane intersects, the banks, whether they be slopes, whether they be accretion banks, or whether they be other kinds of banks, erosion banks, that's where the boundary lies. Colonel Stiles said the one time in which the boundary, the gradient boundary, will lie right on the feather edge of the water, as he put it, is when the river is flowing at precisely the depth of that benchmark. When the river is flowing at precisely that depth, then the water in the river, as it intersects the land up and down the river, will mark the gradient boundary. Now, that's a rare occasion when that exact point happens, so there has to be a way to do it otherwise. But what that tells you is that the bank on which that gradient boundary is marked can't be a half a mile, a quarter of a mile away from the flowing water, because that's what marks the boundary along the bank after you've passed your qualified bank. So I probably answered more than you asked, but that's, I think, why we say and where we get right to the nub of this case. Can you mark the gradient boundary on a bank that is a quarter of a mile away from where the flowing water has been for three decades?
Do you have the parties don't debate where the gradient boundary was before the Sanford Dam was completed in 1955, do they?
We do. We do debate that.
What is the argument there?
We don't. On that issue, there was no gradient boundary done before 1965. No gradient boundary marked. The state has gone out and marked what they say the gradient boundary was.
All right, and you disagree with that. But in any event, the landowners and the state do agree that the gradient boundary was perhaps at a point that indicated a larger bed than what you say it is now.
I suspect that's true, but I'm not prepared to concede that, and here's why. I think what they mark are old flood banks. They marked the gradient boundary prior to 1965 at banks that were carved out as floods went down that river. We don't know where the normal flow of that river was at that point in time. They started with flood banks, and today they're at flood banks.
Well, is it the landowner's position then that there was no change in the gradient boundary as a result of the completion of the Sanford Dam?
We suspect there was, because the land is dramatically changed out there. We just can't tell you what it is, because nobody did a gradient boundary survey before 1965.
Right. If we assume that there was a change between the gradient boundary before the dam was completed and after, what is the legal effect of the completion of the Sanford Dam on the ownership rights of the riverbed?
We say there's no effect.
That
why? The dam is, I mean, the normal rules of riparian ownership apply. Reliction, accretion, erosion, those normal rules continue to apply. The normal rule of the gradient boundary still applies. You go out and do a gradient boundary survey today, just like you would have done it in 1960.
Now, do the normal riparian rule, landowner owner rules, actually apply usually as a result of natural events as opposed to man-made events, or are there cases in which a man-made event has caused a change in the course of a river and riparian ownership right rules have been applied?
Our view is, and I think the cases are consistent, even to the point where there's an ALR annotation on this point on our side, saying that the normal rule from the beginning of time down to the present is that man-made influences on the course of the river do not affect the operation of the normal property rules that I've described. That's the artificial change theory. That's the state's artificial change theory. When you get right down to it, the only thing the state has to support that artificial change theory is their attorney general's opinion from about 1970. If you look at the best authority, the point at which it's discussed in the most detail is in the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Bonelli County. They discussed the artificial change theory in great detail. Got a lot of writing since then, citing Bonelli. There's a really good article in the Arizona Law Review, which we've cited, that talks about that particular theory. Here's the distinction that I think is important here. If a landowner goes onto land and directly, or if man, let's back off the land, if man goes onto the river and directly affects the riverbed, fills the riverbed is the most common case. That's the Ellis Island case, which they've cited. New York goes on to Ellis Island and they filled it. It's an island, but it's the same concept. Then that does not change the ownership of that particular filled land. That is not a riparian rights issue. But if you go 15, 20 miles up the river, in our case 15 at a minimum, 45 at a maximum, and do something to influence the water, and the water is the only connection between your land down here where we're looking at something and this change way up here, which we did not do. Had we done it, it might have been different, but we did not do it. then the normal rules of riparian ownership apply. I've always been mystified at this artificial change theory. There are two dams on this river in New Mexico that were there before this dam was there. Those dams cut this river off from its headwaters. Those dams cut this river off from its snowmelt flow. But the state doesn't want to talk about those two dams. This quest for a river in its natural state, which is what this case is really,
let me ask,
I think, you, bottom
let me,
of that.
Stop you there, because I'm a little bit confused.
Okay.
I can't tell by your arguments. Are you talking about that as a matter of law, their survey that they did estimating pre-building of the dam is not the right one because
correct.
It didn't measure the water flow then? Or are you saying it's not the right one because the water flow has to be measured as of today?
As of today. If you're going to do a survey on the river, you have to survey the river as it exists today.
Okay. Now, in that regard, I feel like reading the briefing, we got in the middle of the argument. One survey is better than another survey, but I don't have a lot of help on what really was the interest of the state and the parties historically in riparian issues. Is it an oversimplification to say that the state's ownership of a riverbed was simply where the river flowed?
No, it is not an oversimplification.
So if the river changes its flow for whatever reason, the state has no residual interest in the dry land.
Absolutely.
It simply has its interest changes with wherever the river flows.
Absolutely correct.
Where does that interest, when does that interest change? At what point, when you have a river that, through the seasonal changes, spreads out over a half a mile, not flood stage, but seasonal changes, spreads out over a half a mile, and then in the dry season is down to a trickle, where does the change occur 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 6 years ago, where we have an ultimate determination that the river has, in fact, changed its course?
I think, Your Honor, you have the rules apply to the normal stages of a river through a year. So if you have a normal stage of a river, it's going to be run a little higher in certain parts of the year than it does in other parts of the year. When it rains a little bit, it's going to come up, and that happens today.
Well, I'm accepting the gradient flow theory as this level you determined, but I'm just saying, at what point in the historical movement of the river
how long does it have to move?
Yes, I mean, do we have to go out there and every day measure or every 6 months measure, or can we measure 30 years ago based on how slow the river moves, or do we have to?
I think all of the authorities agree that a gradient boundary survey is good on the day the gradient boundary survey is done. And in fact, the decrees in Oklahoma versus Texas and the decree by the trial court in this case decrees the boundaries subject to future accretion, reliction, and avulsion. Erosion. So you're right. I mean, the river can change on a day-to-day basis. Normally it doesn't. And here
so your point would be that the only good survey is the one that was done yesterday, because the one done 3 days ago or one guesstimating 30 years ago is not the way you do a gradient survey.
One does not go do a gradient survey trying to recapture conditions that existed 20 years ago.
And so we don't have to address whether it was a dam or not a dam. The fact of the matter is, it's what happened yesterday is the way you run a survey.
What about situations where you have a river and there's a dam placed there, and 2, 3, 4 times a year water is let out of the dam, and the river is used basically to swing section of the river to take the excess water. For example, the Colorado, where you have certain fixed level lakes, but there are portions of the Colorado that change dramatically. What do you do in those situations?
That is not the situation we have.
I understand.
In those situations, you have a normal flow of the river, and then you have floods that come down the river, and there are cases about that. When there is normally a normal flow of the Colorado. And I think the situation is that the people who let the water out of the dams do let the water out in such a way as to have a relatively normal flow of water.
Knowing that they're going to flood.
No, well,
or knowing that it's going to rise.
Knowing that it's going to rise, but not knowing that it's going to flood. And you do have cases involving those very, very kinds of situations where something is perceived to have been done negligently, which there's a tort immunity for, or where, in fact, a big decision was made just to take over some more land to flood it, to make a new lake. And those are different kinds of cases. But I don't think that that's a big problem. That's what goes on rivers all around where a normal release is made. In this case, in our river, the river authority has said that when the Lake Meredith gets up to a certain level, they will start releasing water.
So what's going to be the effect of that on the boundary?
Then I think as a normal flow of the river increases and widens, then the boundary widens. There's no question about that.
Why is that not problematic? It just seems as though if that were the case, the state would be sitting on a petition that they would have ready, prepared to file, and on that day when the river banks are wider because of letting the water out, they're going to run down to the courthouse and say, okay, this is the new boundary today, give us back our land.
Well, I don't think they'd have to go down to the courthouse. If the river permanently occupies more land, then because of what Justice Enix said,
well, your definition of permanent changes from day to day is the problem, the way I heard you a second ago. You said the most recent survey is the one that counts.
The most recent survey marks the boundary as of that date. That's right.
And so
but it's always subject to change.
And if between today and the day we issue our opinion, the state changes its policy and decides to start letting a whole lot more water go through that dam, why would your position not be mooted?
My position wouldn't be mooted. My position is one still goes down and marks the river boundary in accordance with where the flowing water is, not a half mile up in
the Mr. Powell, don't we have other interests, though, that are affected by this? I take it the state has always owned this riverbed. This is sovereign land.
The state owns the riverbed, whatever the riverbed
exactly,
is.
Exactly, I understand, but no one else has ever owned that riverbed, whatever it may be, but the state.
That's right.
And there's never been any severance of, like, the mineral estate from the surface.
Correct.
And if the boundary changed, then I take the ownership of the minerals would change.
That's correct.
So one day the state might own the minerals, and the next day the landowners may own the minerals.
That's the nature of riparian ownership.
Then is the effect, though, if the state owns that land in the riverbed pre-dam, and it was a larger area than what you say it is right now, what is the legal effect of the state having built the dam, change the gradient boundary, and I guess effectively abandon the minerals?
No,
is there any effect under Texas law with the state having taken that action with respect to the ownership of that land?
45 miles down the river, no. I don't think there's any effect in Texas law on that. It doesn't make any difference why the river moved. The state's ownership of the fee under the river is a determinable fee. It's a base fee. It's subject to divestment by the movement of the water. If the river moves over here a little bit, the state's ownership moves. And the reason for that, and there's some wonderful old cases about this, the reason why the sovereign always owns the land under a river, the same reason that today the sovereign always owns the land under a highway. Back in the days these laws were created, the rivers were the commerce ways. And the sovereign needed to own the water, land under the water, to preserve the river, and that's why this just applies to navigable rivers.
Okay, Mr. Powell, but let's follow this up. Riparian rights, again, this is a historical perspective about this. It's easy to imagine that the river itself was not habitable. You lived on the land. The river was only used for transportation. So the state owns that, and wherever it goes, that's where the highway goes. But now you've got a permanent interest, the minerals underneath. And it's one thing to say the state's property is only what's under the water. That's fine. But the river meanders. And where the river goes, it's no longer private property. It's state property.
Right.
So it moves today, and the landowner now owns the land where the river no longer is. And they put a permanent structure there. And the structure is to retrieve the minerals. The water flows back and goes over the gas well or the oil well. Now, is there a takings problem?
I don't think there is.
So the state just now owns that oil well?
I think that's probably right. I don't know whether...
Sure, you might agree with that?
I don't know. I think you could still get to the well. But that's an issue. We don't have any wells in this area.
But the question, but it seems to me that that's one of the issues that didn't exist historically when riparian interests were talked about. That is an issue now. The value really what's under the water, not the fact that the water's a highway.
That's exactly what gave rise to Oklahoma versus Texas. That very problem. Discovery of oil up in Wichita County. They start off the opinion. This was of no concern to anybody until there were oil wells drilled in the Red River in Wichita County. And the Supreme Court dealt with that problem, which is the way I think the laws dealt with it over the decades, and that is to say, while it's interesting, it has no effect on the boundary. The value of the minerals underneath the land, whether they're over here under the state's land or they're over here under the riparian's land, has no effect on where the boundary is. That specific issue is dealt with in Oklahoma versus Texas.
I have two questions.
Yes, sir.
Why is it the necessary implication of your position that the land immediately below the dam, the riverbed immediately below the dam, is no longer the state's?
I don't know what the one thing when we have never looked at that land up there. It may be that that land was condemned. I don't know what the state did immediately below the dam.
Well, I mean 5, 6, 7, 8 miles.
There is water running there. It is not running in the same kind of a stream that the water runs in our area. I don't know what one would do if you were to set out to make a gradient boundary survey. But there is flowing water. It runs in small rivulets, and it is interrupted frequently by roads that have been put, and culverts that have been put under the roads, and pipelines, and dams and dikes created around oil wells, gas wells. But it seems to me that the state flirts with the idea, you know, that we've got the 30-foot wide rule in this state. This is not a navigable, in fact, this is a navigable in law river, because from its headwaters under the statute to the time it passes out of the state, it has an average of 30 feet wide. There is an argument that could be made, I suppose, that there is no 30-foot wide river in that area anymore. And I don't think this court's ever dealt with the question of whether that 30-foot wide means right there or, you know, on some sort of an average. But I think that, I mean, there is an interesting question about that land. But I don't think that question is in this case. I think that's another case.
If the state is right in its legal position, is there anything wrong with its survey? Should it get summary judgment on its survey?
On its survey? Its survey is not the answer is no. Its survey is not a proper gradient boundary survey.
And you have summary judgment evidence raising the fact
that
yes,
we do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Mary Keeney will present argument for the respondent.
The state seeks in this case rendition on its summary judgment motion that it has established as a matter of law the boundary of the Canadian River along the 40-mile stretch of the riverbed that's in dispute in this case. We would also request whether this court renders or remands that the court address the two critical questions that are presented here. The first is whether the state is correct in its contention that the accretion bank formed by the sediment deposits from the water flow of the Canadian River constitute the proper bank on which to establish the gradient boundary. The second is whether the state is correct in its assertion that the decrease in the river's water flow resulting from the closing of Sanford Dam in 1965 cannot be used as a basis for defeating the state's ownership of its riverbed. An affirmative answer to either of these questions eliminates the real dispute. The answer to the first question turns on what this court finds are the important and controlling aspects of the gradient boundary methodology that the U.S. Supreme Court established in Oklahoma versus Texas, and this court adopted in Model versus Board. Those two decisions firmly establish that it is the bank of the river, rather than the water in the river, that determines determines the location of the river bank. Both of those decisions also recognize that the rivers in the western parts of the United States have expanded beds with extensive areas of dryness. In fact, in the Oklahoma decision, the Supreme Court recognized that the Red River, that dryness was the prevailing condition. There is not water up against that bank all the time.
Do you agree or disagree with his demonstration of how to determine the gradient boundary?
I agreed until we got to the point of the flowing water, Your Honor. We had the notion of locating the bank, although from a standpoint of the kind of bank that they would locate, it has to be, the key bank needs to be an accretion bank, because that's basically a permanent bank. And in fact, I think that solves one of the problems that the court's talking about, how the rivers change all the time. Well,
why do you disagree with flowing water segment?
Well, because what you don't look for a bank that's adjacent, that abuts the flowing water. That's what the trial court held, that's what the trial court said, their survey showed, and that's why the trial court granted them summary judgment.
But you agree that at some point in the seasonal flow of the water, that bank would be touching water at some point?
Yes. That under the standard gradient boundary methodology that was contemplated in Oklahoma versus Texas and Model.
And if the water never touched that boundary, then that's not the right boundary.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. That presents a different question. And first of all, we submitted the summary judgment evidence. In this case, it shows that the water does reach our bank.
How?
How often? We have expert testimony that says on a regular basis we have statistical studies that show when it rains about 1.5 inches a year, it will reach certain places on that bank. And so it won't flow bank to bank, probably more than a few times a year.
In your briefing, you describe this river as a braided river. Is there disagreement or agreement as to that characterization of the river? Is it a braided river?
We consider it to be a braided river. Their surveyor disagreed. He basically, because he considers the river to be the 20 to 50 foot channel that he defined as the river.
And are you able to reach the outer banks as the state defined it because of the fact that it is a braided river or because of higher water conditions generally, because of flooding?
It's not because of flooding. It's basically because of the tributaries that do feed into this river all along this disputed area. We have basically 92%. From what the record evidence will show is that we've had Sanford Dam cut off 92% of the water flow through this riverbed from everything upstream of the dam. We have 18 tributaries that feed into not their channel, but the state bed as we've defined it. And if you'll look on our surveying maps, you will see where those tributaries flow in. We have 18 tributaries there. We have, I think there's half dozen to a dozen between Sanford Dam and the disputed area, because the disputed area begins about 15 miles downstream.
When you're talking about tributaries, you're talking about the effect that tributaries have. Are you talking about the state takes the outer banks being on the opposite sides of the tributaries all the way through the riverbed, or what are you saying about the tributaries?
I'm saying that they basically feed water into the bed and put water in that bed basically every time it rains.
I'm puzzled that after all of this work, we don't know with greater certainty whether the water ever washes up against these banks or not. How can there be a dispute about that after all of the effort that has gone into this case? Looks like somebody can stand out there with a camera and see whether it does or it doesn't, and how often and under what circumstances, and then we know the answer to that.
Well, Your Honor, what we have is our summary judgment evidence, and really all we have is what the state has put on. We had two hydrologists out there who studied the water conditions, and both of them concluded that water would still reach the state banks. We've had our state surveyor who was out there. He was out there in a flood situation and observed it, but he was also out there after just a substantial rainfall.
And floods don't count, you agree with that?
Floods do not count under a standard gradient boundary.
What about their single gauge? They put in that one gauge saying it never got that high. Is that accurate or not?
I don't think that they ever had a gauge that they set actually on the disputed area. I think maybe their surveyor had looked at some gauges. But I think the studies that we had made of the rainfall of the area are the only studies done by any qualified experts on the inundation of the area.
I'm a little bit confused by the state survey. Some data was used that was pre-Sanford Dam, 30-year-old data or more, and some was current data.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
How, if you're trying to establish the gradient boundary as of this point in time, why are you using data from two different periods of time? And how does that fit with the Oklahoma versus Texas gradient water, gradient boundary theory?
Okay. First of all, the reason we take the position that these are not historical banks is because the surveyor went out there and physically located the bank. That's the first part of the gradient boundary methodology, which plaintiff's counsel explained, is that you go out and you find these accretion banks. And he found the lowest accretion banks along the bank of the riverbed. And those banks were created pre-dam, but they still exist today. They haven't gone away.
But you agree, or do you, that in riparian interest, it's really where the river flows that determines the boundary?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that it's the riparian interest deals with the flow of the water, but what you need to look at...
So if the water doesn't flow there anymore, then it's no longer boundary.
If the water never flows there anymore, there's a question of whether the state's boundary necessarily moves.
I guess my point is you couldn't say we're going to go 3 decades ago and say if that was the boundary 3 decades ago, then it must be the boundary today. I mean, you can't do that.
Under Ray versus State, we submit that we could if that change from 3 decades ago is the result of Sanford Dam. We think there's still inundation. There's still water. That bed still serves a purpose. That bed still contains water.
Under the apparent interest, the state owns this highway of water. Is it your position that the state could rechannel this water, could take this water and create another channel, send it down into another riverbed, and now claim state owns half a mile of real estate that it could sell to a developer and do whatever it wants to because it just artificially changed the boundary of the water?
Under Ray versus State, that is precisely what happened to the Trinity River as it ran through Dallas. That's exactly what happened. That's what all those city and county levy district cases are about. And that there was a project involving the rivers, and it also ran through Fort Worth. The Baracus case, the federal case that we cite, discusses exactly the same thing happened in Fort Worth.
And you're saying that didn't amount to where the water no longer flowed didn't amount to an abandonment of that, and the state still owned that
property? Well, in those cases, that's exactly what the courts have. And they, in fact, you know, I guess rereading everything, you always come across something you feel like you missed. And actually, the Ray versus State case does rely on the Supreme Court authority. I guess we've always struggled with the fact that we don't have precise Supreme Court authority, but on page 663 of that decision, they rely on a case called Anderson versus Polk, which is a very old Supreme Court decision that deals with the river running through San Antonio. And under an old statute, the city itself had control over the river there. They rechanneled it. And it was a mandamus case where a party was trying to force the state to sell this as unappropriated public domain, the abandoned riverbed. There really isn't a question that the state continued to own it, which is a basic proposition that we have here, that if you do cut off the water flow, the state still owns the bed if you cut it off with a dam project or a rechanneling project. And what the court there held, and it's not the discussion's not very extensive in Anderson, but the court refused to issue the mandamus. And the reason it did is because it said this wasn't established as unappropriated public domain. Well, Your Honor, it's not unappropriated public domain because riverbeds are not, even after they are made dry, unappropriated public domain. They're considered submerged lands that the commissioner of the General Land Office is not permitted to sell unless the legislature specifically authorizes that.
So your position would be if the dam cut off all the water, the state would still own the dam?
Yes, that's what...
But if the river just dried up of its own, would you still own the bed?
If the river completely, naturally abandoned this area, I think the state But for the minerals would lose its interest in this bend.
But for the minerals.
But
that's
for
what we're talking about here.
Well, that's part of what we're talking about. But I mean, and I guess that would have to be a novel proposition that we would have some basis for maintaining ownership of the minerals.
You would still keep the minerals below the bed, even if the river dried up of its own.
Well, quite frankly, Your Honor, if we don't have a basis for owning the surface, we don't have existing legal authority to justify ownership of the bed if it naturally changes.
You were about to say you disagreed with the plaintiff's counsel about, and it sounded like you were going to talk about the change. Maybe you weren't.
Well,
a minute or so ago, but let me just
ask. Oh, yes, on what, I'm trying to remember where I was, and I think I can get back to it. What we disagree with is about the water flow. Because again, if you look at the Oklahoma versus Texas decision, they don't let, there's a problem. You've got well-defined banks on these rivers, these prairie rivers that are braided streams, and you can recognize those banks. I think if you look at some of the photographs, particularly when Sanford Dam was being constructed, you can see that bed. It is obvious that the state survey tracks the bed of the Canadian River. And the bank has an essential permanence. It can shift. It can change if you have waters rush through that can cause erosion. There can be some accretion.
If it changes naturally, do you agree with the plaintiffs that ownership rights change as well?
Yes, and in fact, that's why we say we found the current banks, because our surveyor went out there and located the banks as they existed in the late 1880s and early 1990s. Right. So yes, that's why we say we found the current banks, and they do have a permanence to them.
I get the sense you want some of both. You want us to say that the law of dams, basically, allows you to keep the riverbed whether there's any water or not. But then you say, is it the alternative that there is water in this riverbed on a frequent enough basis to allow you to maintain?
We think it's a frequent enough basis. And I think that's the critical first question
let me ask it this way. If we decide with the landowners to say the dam doesn't affect the analysis, do you lose or not?
We do not think we necessarily lose.
Would the boundaries be the same? Made that legal determination.
That the dam
would your survey boundaries be accurate?
We think they would continue to be accurate. What we have is we have basically one problem with not meeting the Oklahoma versus Texas case. We still have water inundation. We don't have the kind of water inundation that the Oklahoma court, that the Supreme Court contemplated in Oklahoma, or that this court contemplated in Marble versus Boyd, where it's scoured clear. We don't get enough inundation to scour all of that hydrophytic flora that we've got growing in that soggy sand bed that still exists today. We don't have enough to scour that clear. And so what they have used is the absence of that kind of inundation, and they have gone out and found a 30-foot channel that doesn't exist for the first 7 or 8 miles of the river, and said, this is where our river is.
Well, they say in their brief that at one point your survey has the river being 7,000 feet wide.
I think there is one point at which it is. It averages about 3,400 feet.
How often does water touch the banks in that 7,000-foot wide stretch?
I don't know if we have a precise calculation on that particular stretch.
Is there any evidence that water's ever touched the banks on that 7,000-foot wide stretch?
I don't think there's any evidence one way or the other, Your Honor.
What about their argument
on
that in 7 or 8 places the river's 4,500 feet?
I would have to go back and look at the Brandon's where he had the actual locations of those particular degradation lines where he actually did the calculations, and I think they're still on the wider parts of the river.
And what evidence is there in the summary judgment record that there was water flowing at any point in time to those wider places of the riverbed?
What we have are two hydrologists who examined the river. One of them has a study that found in fairly general terms, that there would be some inundation. The other had a detailed study that found whenever we had, say, 1.5 inches of rain for a 24-hour period, it would reach these banks.
And has that happened in the last 30 years?
That happens virtually every year. And the other thing I think is important to note is that while the water may not go to our banks more than once or twice, 3 times a year, it's going to be out of their banks on a regular basis. Our surveyor they talk about the little rivulets of water that are up there in the 7 to 8 mile area. Those are all over that bend. Our surveyor has found those, and basically that was one of his criticisms of their survey, is that they ignore all of those little bitty braided channels that you'll find all over that river bed. And really the evidence and the common sense will tell you every time it rains in that part of the country, that whole watershed feeds into there with all those 20 to 30 tributaries. And you've got water all over that bed because that's where it goes. It stops. Those tributaries stop at the base bound. They don't stop at that 30-foot channel, which basically came into existence because we've got a sewage treatment plant in Borger, and we've got a couple of industrial plants that start to send off effluent and have created essentially a permanent flowing stream that runs through their property.
If the flow above the dam of the river were diminishing, so that if the dam weren't there, the flow below the dam would be diminishing, I guess using pre-1965 data wouldn't be justified.
If it were?
If the natural flow of the river above the dam were diminishing, then it would not be justified to use pre-1965 data below the dam.
Right, but again, well, I'm not sure I would agree with that, Your Honor, because what the point was to using the 1960 water data was just to get the plane of the water. And that's where we disagree, is that it's not where the water's flowing. All you use on a gradient, via gradient of the water, what you need the water flow for, why we use the 1960 data, is you need to know the gradient. And that's the rate of fall. It falls.
Well, but your theory presumes that it will be, the water level will stay the same in the Canadian River from 1960 to eternity. And it might not, from natural causes.
I think that's true. I think if the river starts, if natural conditions change enough to change those banks, then the boundary would change. But under the gradient boundary method, you do still have the banks that establish it, so that you have the ability to deal with the rivers that we have in Texas. Not all rivers. Rivers really up in the plains and the semi-arid areas, where they're essentially, they're basically not navigable. In fact, they're navigable in law because they're 30 feet wide from the mouth up, the average then. And they are essentially non-perennial streams where you have your rains, and that's when those beds get, you have seasonal rains, and that's when you get water in those beds.
What is your response to the opposing side's position that it is the most recent survey that counts? And to put that into some perspective, even you can see that over time the boundaries may change. And how recent and what kind of time interval between?
I think they can change. We are not seeking a fixed boundary, although I think Ray versus State does justify that. We have found banks that existed in the 1980s and early 90s. Under basic concept of riparian ownership, the river banks can change over time and shift.
But I'm talking about the frequency or recency of survey requirements.
I think that there's a relative permanence to the state's boundaries at this point. They are subject to change if those banks change. We've got to go ahead and have a boundary. If we get judgment for the state, that doesn't necessarily mean that boundary can't change 10 years from now.
So the construction of the dam did not change the banks of this river. Is that the state's position?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me follow up on Justice Abbott's question. Let's presume that we hold the landowners, and then next week the dam is destroyed, or the decision is made to tear down the dam. So now we have water flowing over property that belongs to the landowners, according to their survey. At what point does the state acquire title to those properties again? Are we stuck with that survey, and for how long is that survey binding in determining the ownership of these properties?
I think that's the very problem with the plaintiff's claim of ownership in this case, Your Honor, is that we are facing a problem. What if we do have inundation? And I think their suggestion that if the state floods it, if it's declared to be theirs and the state floods it tomorrow, they have suggested there's a takings. They've said, well, there's official immunity for negligence. There's not official immunity for intentional flooding of land. So I think that that shows the one of the crux of the policy problems of judgment on their behalf. And I, if I could interject one other thing.
Anybody want to?
Please.
One
thing.
I know I'm not supposed to do that, but they said there's a dispute about our pre-dam survey. We disagree with that. Their own surveying expert said that as a pre-dam survey, our survey is accurate. And as I was going through the orders last night getting ready for this argument, one of the things that occurred to me is that even the trial court recognized that. He found that what's in dispute, and this is in his order of, it was his amended order on the plaintiff's second motion for partial summary judgment under our tab B, that what's in dispute is what was covered by the gradient boundary it established prior to 1965 when Sanford Dam was closed and the gradient boundary, what he considered gradient boundary today. So even the trial court recognized there was never any legitimate dispute about the accuracy of that survey as a previous survey.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
There is a sort of an emperor's new clothes type quality to the state's banks, and let me make sure that we all understand what our belief about the state's banks is. The state surveyor looked at aerial photographs to start with. He's testified to this, it's in the record. He looked to see where the old sand bed was. What the state surveyor did was to find the floodplain that existed before the dam was there. When the floods used to come down the river, their geomorphologist said one that was big enough to create these banks came down 9 times in recorded history. And he has essentially then gone out into the floodplain today, which is grown up with grasses up to here and trees, cattle are down in there, and he's down in there. And he's found these vestiges of these old banks that are still there. They're still there. They haven't been touched by water except raindrops on top of them for a long period of time. We didn't move to strike Dr. Brandis's affidavit because I thought that was one of the best pieces of evidence there was in the record for the landowners. Dr. Brandis, he was one of their hydrologists, went up there and did some calculations to determine what it would take to reach the state's boundaries. What kind of a rainfall would it would take in the entire watershed feeding the river at that point, all these tributaries that council has spoken of. The one on the east side of the bank, range line 15.9, and this is tedious, I know we put it in our briefs, but it is very compelling and it speaks right to Justice Owens' question. It takes about a 2.5 to 3 inch rain for the water over a 24-hour period, all over the floodplain, not just a cloudburst. And I grew up there. Most of the rain comes in a big cloudburst. You have a cloudburst that comes through and goes through about 5 or 6 miles and rains. This requires a massive rainfall. They have a rain gauge that Dr. Brandis measured at Porter, which is the closest city to this point of the gradient boundary. Once every 4 to 5 years, it comes a big enough rain at Porter to reach those banks. Now, a rain at Porter once every 4 to 5 years is not big enough. It's got to rain at Spearman, 30-some miles up the road.
Let me interrupt. Again, you're talking about one isolated point.
Right.
What about Hurst's assertion in the brief and just now in open court that at least once or twice a year, there's 1.5 inch rain?
There's no proof of that in the record, and I don't think that's true. There is evidence in the record that about once a year at Borger, there's a 1.5 inch rain. That's not good. There's got to be a 1.5 inch rain at Spearman and at all points in between and almost down to Canadian.
And at Spearman, there's a 1.5-inch rain, according to the record, about once every year and a half. And there's no showing of how often the 1.5-inch rain came at Border on the same day it came at Spearman. So these banks are, you have to go on an archaeological dig to find them.
Let me, how do you respond to the state's position that if we were to adopt the landowner's position in the case, it would discourage public works projects?
I don't think it has never discouraged public works projects before. I mean, all up and down this river, they put dams on. What it is, if in fact the effect of a public works project is to take the riparian nature, is to take it away of the landowner's land, then they have to pay for it. They can't just... The Supreme Court in Bonilla Capitol spoke to this. The state can't just put in a public works project and take people's property rights and not pay for it. If that's what they want to do, then that's what they have to do. And that's just part of the cost of the public works project.
But you agree it would have a chilling effect on public works projects?
I don't think it would, Your Honor. I mean, it seems to me that you've got the federal government building the dam up there, the state running the dam for its flood control purposes. I don't think that, this fight has turned into one big fight. There's no question about that. But this amount of land down there that they're talking about is not that significant in terms of the state's ownership down that river.
The state, when they operate the dam, they not only give up title to their land, but any time that they want to flood it, they have to pay for the land.
We've never said that, Charlie. I think we have to distinguish, and Justice Gonzalez spoke of this, I think we have to distinguish between a permanent change in the flow of the river as opposed to some big flood event where they let water out of the river and it rushes down through the river and in 3 days it's gone. That's one situation. Where I think the boundary changes is that if something happens, if they decide to open Sanford Dam and discontinue that dam, or if they decide that every month we'll let out so many hundreds of acre feet of water, and you have a permanent, over the course of a year, change in the character of the river. The river will cut some new channels. The river will likely be wider in places. It will be shallower in places. All those things will happen. If that becomes the permanent nature of the river, then automatically, I think under the rules of riparian ownership, the state's boundary moves and the state owns the land under the flowing water, and the riparians have to give up river. That's right. We're a victim. And that could happen any time. I mean, as the Supreme Court said in Bonilla Cattle, the riparian is not only subject to losing land and subject to gaining land by the natural forces, but he's subject to losing land and gaining land by what people do way up the river.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
What prompts a gradient boundary survey? If I understand the record, these two are the only ones that have been done on this. Is it somebody gets unhappy and there's a dispute and that's when you do a survey, or there was some comment about you could do them every other day because water changes?
Well, you don't need to do it every other day. I mean, we had an issue in this case and it prompted a dispute up there, and the issue essentially was, is the boundary a half mile up there or is it down here?
So basically then, somebody disputes the boundary, which gives rise to the litigation and the appointment of surveyors for both sides, and the trial court looks at it.
That's one way. That's what happened in this case.
And what supports your viewpoint that you have to look at what's current and not what happened 30 years ago?
If you read the gradient boundary literature, you read Oklahoma versus Texas and Colonel Stiles' article, Colonel Stiles starts his description of the boundary by saying, if you want to get a good idea of what it's going to look like, walk along the flowing river and watch where the river touches the land. And you can do that with our survey, but you sure can't do it with their survey. You can walk along their banks and you just kind of widen your waist to the creek.
But when you say when the river touches the land, it's within the framework of your demonstration on how you find where the boundary
correct,
is,
John.
The top and the bottom.
Correct, John.
So did I understand you say that even Colonel Stiles says there is one time when some time in the evolution, the water will touch the actual gradient boundary.
That's what he calls the boundary at the feather edge of the water issue.
Mr. Powell, very quick question. It's just a technical question. A dam, unlike rechanneling a river or something, arguably
all things being the same, the water flowing into the lake leaves through the dam at the same rate. Otherwise, I mean, you'd overflow the top of the dam.
That's never happened at this dam. Theoretically, that's correct. This dam has never been overflowed.
Well, but that can only mean that either the evaporation off the top of the lake or the absorption by the ground must be at a greater rate than the water coming into the lake from above it.
Well,
right. I mean, I'm just asking.
They use the water. They take the water out of it.
Is there some discussion? The state says by building this dam, you don't get the benefit of a change in the deal. And I'm just, is there some evidence in the record regarding the use of the water that is because of the dam that's greater than the water flow coming into the dam? And so there really is a change in the water flow below the dam that is as a result of something, water being taken out of the dam.
The water is used to provide municipal water to Amarillo and about 10 or 12 other cities up there, including Lubbock. The main purpose of the dam, two main purposes, one was flood control, and one was providing municipal water to the cities up in the past. So that most of the water, I think, goes out for that purpose.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council. The court will take a brief recess.
All right.